Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode is the keynote address by author Jonathan Lethem, given at the first annual Upstate Anarchist Book Fair, held May 4th and 5th, 2024 in Binghamton, New York. Jonathan Lethem, spelled L-E-T-H-E-M, is the author of The Fortress of Solitude and Motherless Brooklyn, as well as more recent bestsellers, The Feral Detective and The Arrest. Several of his novels have been made into major movies, and his shorter works can often be found in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and many other venues. One of the MacArthur Genius Grant winners, Lethem is well known and widely respected for his vivid literary style, sardonic humor, and deep understanding of American culture.
So I'm going to start by reading a little bit of this short story, just from the beginning of it. I'm Jonathan Lethem. So this story is called The Collapsing Frontier, which is the story that gives this little book from PM Press its title. And it's kind of a Western story. The characters ride into the story aboard a 1984 Winnebago Mini Winnie, one driven breakneck across broiling asphalt, overspilling its lane on both sides. Though the story's characters are themselves oblivious, the story acknowledges that it is being written on stolen Tongva land. Indeed, the same Tongva land toward which the recreational vehicle now barrels. The story gives respect and reverence to those who came before it, which ought to be absolutely everyone, even you, reader, since the story does not yet and may never exist. Yet here it seems to come, the story and the recreational vehicle. The Winnebago, like a bread box, rumbling westward on fat, half-melted tires. A monster's bread box with its bragging orange stripe. Side view mirrors, flying buttressed a full foot from its cab to make it minimally navigable. The story already occupies too much space, demands too much attention. Watch where you're going. Who's driving this thing? A dad in mirrored aviator shades? Why, of course. He's Robert Crumb's white man. He's Albert Brooks in Lost in America. He's the exhausted normative protagonist. Our movie's leading man, there's no way to avoid him. Or maybe there is. Maybe one of his kids or his long-suffering wife can provide us with a marginally improved point of view, a parallax position from which to operate. Some oxygen here, though it may be that all the oxygen is recirculated within the tightly sealed Winnebago. They all breathe the same air, surely. At least we can't hear the music inside. Electric Light Orchestra's greatest hits on 8-track tape. The alternative to following this white man driving the Winnebago is equally unpromising, that we raise up a literary selfie stick and catch a glimpse of the story's writer. We might choose to cast him as the protagonist in a drama of the story's becoming. Or, more likely, a drama of the story's failure to launch, burdened as it is with debts and doubts, with qualms and queasy self-loathing. Of course, and it goes without saying, the story's writer is also male and white, another exemplar of that exhausted normative. And the project of literary self-consciousness is hardly novel, since it has been indulged by so many of the writer's immediate and distant influences, from Kurt Vonnegut and Philip K. Dick to Jorge Luis Borges and Lawrence Stern. This model of self-consciousness has lately been renovated, refurbished under the name autofiction, yet even so, it may be once again an expiring mode. Sure, it offers itself as an exit from the interstate freeway of narrative, the kind of storytelling that doesn't trouble over the existence of the author, just barrels ever forward, claiming the turf of your attention. But perhaps it has proved to be an exit that is closed for repairs, or is simply shut down because no one wishes to go there anymore. Among those who may wish to avoid self-consciousness, the writer of this story. The writer wants to fight to stay on the interstate freeway of storytelling. He wants to get somewhere. He wants to be aboard the Winnebago. If so, this is no way to go about it. Further disclaimers. The story acknowledges borrowing the language of its acknowledgement of its occupation of stolen Tongva land from the website of a collective of spirit healers who will go unnamed in this acknowledgement, for they may not wish to be associated. The story admits it also depends for its existence on the occupation of a text of R.A. Lafferty's Narrow Valley, a text the story's author first encountered in the anthology Other Dimensions, edited by Robert Silverberg in 1973. The story takes place 6 years later, in 1979, the year of Three Mile Island, of the Iranian hostage crisis, of the imminence of the Reagan era. The feeling that the Reagan era was coming is a migraine prodrome, a hangover suffered before a decades-long binge on militarism, bogus optimism, and imperial fantasy that still hasn't abated. Really, what is the 21st century except the endless unspooling of the implications of the Reagan era? But the writer digresses. The clown Emmett Kelly died in 1979, as did John Wayne and Sid Vicious. Natasha Lyonne and Ben Lerner and Pink were born in 1979. The story now acknowledges consulting Wikipedia's 1979 in the United States page. But who is R.A. Lafferty? A writer of science fiction and westerns, Lafferty lived most of his life in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He died at 87 in 2002. He was a Catholic. What's Narrow Valley? A short story that is both a science fiction story and a western story, as well as a kind of tall tale or parable, typical of Lafferty's eccentric style. In it, a white family attempts to purchase, for back taxes, acreage originally given by the U.S. government in a land allotment to a Pawnee Indian named Clarence Big Saddle. The land, in the story, appears from a distance to be a broad and fertile valley with an alluring topography. However, when the white family attempts to enter the valley, it reveals itself as a spatial anomaly, a strip of space between two fences which is too small to enter. Or, when a person such as the white family insists upon entering it, it shrinks and flattens them to fit. That story, published in 1966, still has much to recommend it. Surrealist humor, admirable ethics, a winking self-awareness. The story now acknowledges that by basing itself on a specific earlier short science fiction short story, it is indebted paradoxically to another. Okay, enough of this. The pretzel of this story is an endless series of inabilities to free oneself from the burdens of acknowledgement and disassembling one's debts and paying one's debts. I'm a writer who works constantly. I've always worked with a series of associations and influences that I was very aware of. And by building my work out of a mosaic of these different fragments, popular culture, literature, comic books, things I adored, things I heard other people say, I've instantiated this life that I've lived as an author, ostensibly original, ostensibly capable of inventing stories that don't exist before I wrote them. But of course, I think this is a sort of fiction itself. And so in this story, I'm trying to disassemble authority and show the seams and the stitchery and the indebtedness that is everywhere, and then also describe the problem of and the anxiety that's associated with this. So let me do another thing from this book, which is from a nonfiction piece. It's actually was written as an address originally, and it will do the job of introducing me in a slightly different way. And this was a speech I gave about a lot of things, but about an essay by another writer named Italo Calvino, Italian fabulist. And I gave this talk in January of 2017. So it was a time when everyone was really jittery and confused because of the election that had just taken place. And Calvino himself was a writer who came of age in the middle of the rise of fascism in Italy, and wrote about it initially directly in a bunch of short stories and a couple of times in some essays, but then became a writer of kind of fables and fantastical stories, which is a sense in which he was a very powerful influence on my orientation as a writer. But I grew up in Brooklyn. Anyway, I talk about this in the essay, and this will be useful. It'll connect, I hope, to the things you heard in the beginning of that other short story. This essay, which I won't get anywhere near all the way through either, is called Calvino's Lightness, which is the name of his essay, and The Feral Child of History. I speak as a feral child of Gowanus. That is not to say the name of a currently fashionable bar or restaurant, but a broken city in a broken time. I couldn't have been granted a sufficient precognition to know how my appetite for connection through cultural things, through songs, stories, films, and paintings, would lead me into the position in which I now appear before you. I figured I'd be destined to stay feral, that it was my appetites, in fact, that would keep me so. But look at me now. I've been lured indoors, it's funny because I'm saying this outdoors, into some kind of respectable position. The risk of becoming respectable is to be rendered harmless, of course. Whether harmless or not, inside I remain a creature of the streets. I piece together fragments to make my armor. I don't want to conceal today that I'm piecing together this present confession from such stuff. It's made primarily from portions of two talks I wrote and delivered shortly after the election of November 2016. That autumn was, for my writing, otherwise a kind of Death Valley, until the time in mid-January when I began to be able to assemble a fiction again, a novel called The Feral Detective. In those weeks, I was asked, luckily, to comment on Italo Calvino's essay Lightness, and so I began to read Calvino again. This was a time, an atrocious new age, that was dawning or had had its face revealed. As in the original meaning of William S. Burroughs' title, Naked Lunch, when he was asked to define it, he called it that frozen moment when everyone sees what is on the end of their forks. These fragments that I'm trying to assemble, they won't fit. The more I try to make them say, the more I try to operate them, the more they reveal their insufficiency. I'm destined to abandon rather than finish this project, but that's true of all of the projects. Let me start with a joke. One day, a tiny man entered a cafe and said, I want a double caramel mocha latte, very hot and very sweet. And then he added, and I'm not going to pay because I'm not afraid of anyone. The little man drank his coffee, and indeed, he exited without paying. The cafe owner said nothing, since he was afraid of controversy, afraid of scandal. But when the tiny man repeated the trick a few more times, coming in day after day and demanding a double caramel mocha latte and saying, I'm not afraid of anyone and I'm not going to pay, and leaving without paying, the cafe owner decided he'd had it. So he hired a tough guy who would come and beat up the tiny man if the tiny man returned. So on the fourth day, when the tiny man said, I want a double caramel mocha latte, very hot, very sweet, the tough guy sidles up to him and says, so you're afraid of no one? That's right, says the little man. Well, the big bouncer leans down and says to him, I'm not afraid of anyone either. So the little tiny man turns to the cafe owner and says, make that two double caramel mocha lattes. The joke operates in a way that, for me, the best jokes do, by delivering the listener at the moment of experiencing the punchline from a state of tension into a kind of existential abyss of possibilities. The little man's surprising reaction opens a trap door for an escape from the obvious. What will happen? Will they, in fact, become friends? What would it mean if everyone were to discover in themselves an absolute lack of fear in the face of what seems an unavoidable conflict? Could there possibly be enough double caramel mocha latte to go around? The source of the joke is Jean-Luc Godard's film Alphaville, a movie made in 1965, made the year after I was born. I first saw it in a repertory movie house in New York City when I was 16, and it immediately became a cherished object for me. I don't speak French or Italian, so much like my consideration of Italo Calvino, this movie raises the problem of translation for me. I encountered the film in French with English subtitles. I've taken liberties in making the joke from Alphaville my own. This is what novelists do, take liberties, make things up, make them their own. Alphaville, in truth, supplied me with much more than just the joke. It might be said that it supplied me with my first novel, Gun with Occasional Music, since the film portrays a hard-boiled detective who investigates a crime in a dystopian city of the future. In Godard's variation on my novel, the government seems to have ceded power to a gigantic financial computer, a computer operated by impassive scientists who've grown completely indifferent to human emotions such as love and sorrow. It's a romantic film. The detective falls in love with the lead scientist's beautiful daughter in an archetypal plot that evokes Shakespeare's Tempest, and therefore also the American science fiction film Forbidden Planet, though Godard may have been oblivious to this. It's also a very funny film, despite its terrifying vision. Like George Orwell's 1984, or an episode of Rod Serling's Twilight Zone, or the Wachowskis' film The Matrix, or nearly any other effective dystopian narrative, Alphaville derives its power and relevance not so much from a prediction of a distant future as from a metaphoric distillation of a condition of the present. The present as experienced by the artist, the writer or filmmaker, and understood, at least intuitively, by the reader or audience member on that level. They experience the book or film as delivering to them a truth about the world they live in, as if it is being given its complete name for the first time. In fact, Godard did not shoot Alphaville on soundstages with futuristic science fiction sets or by using CGI. He simply placed his characters in the newest office buildings and scientific laboratories in Paris. In the simplest possible sense, then, Alphaville was Paris in 1965, seen with new eyes. For many reasons, the most powerful insights about the present are often communicated by this process of defamiliarization, by setting reality in a fantastic or allegorical or absurdist framework, one which exaggerates some elusive quality of our experience into visibility. This is not so different from the way a joke or a piece of surrealism or absurdity can lead us to the brink of the existential abyss, to an opening or rupture that is also a place where anything might be possible. Perhaps it is also not so different from the way that a 3-minute pop song can break our hearts by seeming to encapsulate in a few corny lines and gestures, a few well-worn chord progressions, the emotions that strain within us but rarely find a doorway to emerge into our everyday lives. How does the lighter-than-air gesture of the artist, singer, filmmaker, or even the teller of a joke retain its relevance and power in times of darkness? If the artist is a citizen, obligated in times of oppression to acts of mutual aid, reparative justice, and participatory democracy, perhaps even of civil disobedience and personal sacrifice, what is the place of the impulse to fantasy? The playful, mercurial, polymorphous desire of the artist to generate non-utilitarian gestures of irreverence, playfulness, distraction, and delight. Perhaps it is only a residual activity, at best described as a freedom worth preserving, the evidence of whose persistence reassures us that our wish to include areas of free play proves the benevolence of our caretaking of the world. Something like the way we view the ever-diminishing presence of the art teacher in a public school, ever-diminishing yet never quite wiped out completely, as evidence of a tiny indulgence that redeems the merciless pragmatism of a core curriculum, our teaching to the test. In this model, the artist is barely more than a child himself. Or can it be, possibly, that the seeming weightlessness of the artist's existence in our society masks a more essential, more integral purpose? One of crucial value precisely in times of precarity, political incoherence, and disillusion. So this was my way of setting up thinking about Calvino, who'd lived through the birth of fascism in Italy, the growth of the fascist republic, which aligned itself to Nazism. He was enlisted to fight in the Italian army as a young man and was unable to escape this recruitment. Fought, then with some other young soldiers, abandoned the Italian fascist army and fought in the resistance. To say he effectively was a person who, by the time he was 25, had fought on both sides of World War II. Once he was in the resistance, the fascists took his family hostage and in front of him held a gun to his mother's head for what he'd done. And after writing a very small number of realistic, very painful stories about his experiences in the war, turned and spent the next 5 or 6 decades writing effervescent, lighter-than-air, fantastical parables. And the essay of his that I was considering was this one called Lightness. And so it raises this question in the most immediate way. What is the artist's social responsibility, and how can it be reflected in their playful or apparently light, irreverent, fantastical gestures? What is the role of the imagination in a world of immediate political urgency and immediacy? So the last thing I'm going to read to you is not my own words, but Calvino's from that essay. When I began my career, the duty of every young writer, the categorical imperative, was to represent our times. I soon realized that the gap between the realities of life that were supposed to be my raw materials and the sharp, darting nimbleness that I wanted to animate my writing was becoming harder and harder for me to bridge. I sometimes felt that the whole world was turning to stone, a slow petrifaction, more advanced in some people and places than in others, but from which no aspect of life was spared. It was as if no one could escape Medusa's inexorable gaze. So the next part of what he describes extends from the myth of Medusa. And I personally was somehow not very well educated in the classics. I don't know how that happened, but I always have to learn about these things sort of obliquely and absorb even the basic facts of classical mythology from paraphrases like this. I don't know if you guys know this, but Medusa was finally defeated, you know, she who can turn any man to stone, not by Hercules or some other kind of mighty, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger type of warrior with a giant machine gun or something, but she was artfully tricked by Perseus, who's a very fleet, mercurial, kind of lighter-than-air character in the mythology. He's sort of a borderline trickster figure. So this is what Calvino goes on to say. The only hero capable of cutting off Medusa's head is Perseus, who flies on winged sandals. Perseus, who looks not upon the Gorgon's face, but only upon her image reflected in his bronze shield. In order to cut off Medusa's head without being turned to stone, Perseus supports himself on the lightest of stuff, wind and clouds, and turns his gaze towards that which can be revealed to him only indirectly by an image caught in a mirror. The relationship between Perseus and the Gorgon, Medusa, is complex, and it doesn't end with the beheading of the monster. As for the severed head, rather than abandoning it, Perseus takes it with him, hidden in a sack. When in danger of defeat, he only has to show it to his enemies. Perseus masters that terrible face by keeping it hidden, just as he had earlier defeated it by looking at its reflection. In each case, his power derives from refusing to look directly while not denying the reality of the world of monsters in which he must live, a reality he carries with him and bears as his personal burden. Sorry, those paragraphs are absolutely impossible for you to read without crying because of the beauty of the language and the sentiment and Calvino's implicit self-reproach and self-exploration conducted at this time. He was in his late 60s, and in fact, he died of a sudden heart attack before he could deliver this lecture. It was one of the last things he wrote. So, what does that have to do with that crazy, self-reproaching story about the Winnebago and the embarrassment at being a storyteller and the problem of trying to put a character on the highway and moving across this non-existent Western frontier to steal, to plunder native land, the Tongva land in the story? I think for a long time, one of my forms of anxiety that I sublimated in my writing was that of being an author at all, the root word authority. You know, so I've come to feel that a lot of things about storytelling and authority are truly suspicious, obnoxious, treacherous forms of power to wield in the world, and best only done with a kind of constant self-effacement or, you know, an inoculation of doubt and apprehension, and also exposing the trick, laying the cards on the table. So that first story that I began reading for you, Collapsing Frontier, about the narrowing valley, is an attempt to play the cards so preemptively that all you see are the cards. You know, here's where I stole this. Here's what this is about. Here's how I feel as I'm writing this piece. And it comes at a time when I think my work has become even more urgently or openly about disassembling this kind of authority and finding ways in which I can expose the contradictory power of, or the illusion of mastery or authority that lurks inside all kinds of storytelling. And I've written myself further and further into this position of the writer who refuses to make a coherent gesture, which is a different kind of lightness. I think in the earliest stages, I was very much in the spirit of Calvino's essay. I tried always to be funny and also to kind of make these stories occupy cultural space in a delightful way, that they would sort of be, you know, I worked with popular genres over and over again, science fiction, the Western, the superhero story, the hard-boiled detective story. But even my detectives tended to self-disassemble, and I, instead of being exhibiting verbal mastery, you know, the signature of the Humphrey Bogart character, the classical hard-boiled detective, is that he's outgunned, right? He doesn't have the power. The police and the criminal organizations have all the real power, but what he has is verbal wizardry, verbal mastery. Well, so that's what the hard-boiled detective does, is he enters a room and encircles the suspects or the authorities with his mastery of language, his verbal command. And I invented a detective with Tourette's syndrome so that I could reverse this polarity and make him absolutely at the mercy of language at every moment. Whenever he walked into a room, he was completely sort of melting down into inadvertent utterances and saying the quiet part out loud and no mastery whatsoever. So this is a kind of eruption of confessional impulse about the anxiety of being in the position of the storyteller or the authority or the instructor. Now, ironically, I watched everyone else present from down there, sitting in the circle, and I was all excited to be on the ground with you. And then because of the worry about the rain, they've placed me up here so that the sound equipment makes me look like some sort of giant authority figure. But what I would love to do, having rambled at you and read from those two pieces, is, if it's possible, recreate the circumstances a little bit of what I saw going on here and what this gathering exemplifies, and answer questions, but also just hear things from folks, because this day is so compelling to me here.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is the keynote address by author Jonathan Lethem, given at the first annual Upstate Anarchist Book Fair, held May 4th and 5th, 2024, in Binghamton, New York.
That story, Collapsing Frontier, is partly, it's about this whole thing that obsesses me, which is the westward movement, right? So growing up in New York, in Outer Borough, New York, in neighborhoods where there were generations of immigrants, including some very new ones, but also absorbing the myth of New York, the Statue of Liberty, Ellis Island, a lot of preachment about the salad bowl or the mixing pot or whatever it was going to be, soup salad mixture. And my parents were classic 60s era radical idealists who believed that part of transforming the world was civil rights, and that the celebration of, it wasn't called diversity so much then, but just that we were living in a city that was like the melting pot, was so central for me. And eventually I also came to realize that New York wasn't like the rest of the United States, but it took me traveling to get that. So I see New York as this sort of really this amalgamation of European reality, like even the structure of the city, the way the streets are built makes it more, almost more like halfway, you know, it's a halfway point between Europe and the United States. It's a machine for producing Americans, right? And sending them out. And the thing about New York that really seems very definitive to me, that I think about that's super dystopian in a terrifying way, is that it's as obnoxious as the great cities of the world are for different reasons. Their ancient creation was like as centers of fiefdoms or religious centers, powers, non-commercial powers initially. Then they would become, you know, marketplace. But New York City was created by companies. I mean, it's like the first world city that really is born in enterprise, you know, and like the Dutch East India Company, and this is Wall Street. You know, this is really its soul, and its history is so defined by this, which leads to some good things or interesting things for sure. Energies. It was non-sectarian in some ways at the outset, because if you could do business, you were welcome. So people who might not be welcome elsewhere, it was like, well, if you can come make a deal, you can come hang out here. But then it also becomes the, you know, Madison Avenue. It becomes the place where the selling the sizzle, not the steak, is invented. In a sense, it's like the, even though we have Silicon Valley as the official home of virtuality, the business of fooling you, the business of the, what is fundamentally the simulacrum, originates on Madison Avenue. You know, that's where this system of illusions is born. And then again, there's westward expansion and the barreling across the landscape to you know, in the belief in manifest destiny, which is another giant, of course, business concern, really. And the thing about LA, for better or worse, it's the end point. Geographically, it also is symbolically the place where America goes to look at its proposition fulfilled. I mean, you know, the reason that the film industry isn't in New Jersey, where Thomas Alva Edison created the apparatus, is because of it was a search for deregulation, because the people who ran the East Coast were going to make it hard for the movie industry to grow, because, you know, Edison saw that there were too many laws, too many regulations. So it was really about like an early version of this like deregulation, like the wide open. And that's why Hollywood is there, which becomes, of course, the great fulfillment of Madison Avenue's capacity. It's like an unholy alliance between these two places, right? So these European, German, Jewish intellectuals run away from Hitler. They can't get their plays put on in New York City, and so they go to Hollywood to make a fortune writing screenplays. And what do? They invent the American dream. They write these films that create an image that sells a sanitized history. You know, Irving Berlin writes White Christmas. And Jewish-German filmmakers like Fritz Lang make these westerns, you know, that romanticize the frontier. You have this incredible doubleness in, you know, so the sophistication, the ostensible irony and the kind of intellectual density on the East Coast, and the purely mercantile image machine, and then the Silicon Valley, you know, simulacrum machine, the two are really talking to each other at all points. You know, it's back and forth. AI and these large language learning models, I have a number of different feelings about this. I mean, one thing is that it's not as new as it, like it's this kind of rollout that we're experiencing as a pressure on the arts, which is how a lot of people that I know first respond to it, is like, what does it mean for creativity or individual expression? I think it's really worth putting it into the history of how there's no pure state. Literature, language, culture is a fundamentally fractured, plundered, technologized site, right? That we're all participating in something that doesn't have some pure thing that we should enshrine as like, you know, we shouldn't make a kind of a magic symbol out of it. We should notice that like culturally, language itself is an apparatus and a machine of a kind, and that we're always interacting with tools. You know, the book is this imperishable, gorgeous, amazing tool, but it also, it's a container that structures expressivity. And there are people who've theorized this for a long time, both theoretical writers, philosophers, linguists, but also like science fiction writers have done a really good job of anticipating a lot of these thoughts and feelings that we're having now as we're presented with these very particular, you know, like extremely accessible language generating machines. And since I grew up reading a lot of science fiction, much of it seems less startling to me. And I don't say that just to be like, I'm way out ahead of this, but I just think the terms, the current terms of the conversation seem not to make as much use of some of these frameworks or anticipations or allegories. If you read like Borges or Stanislaw Lem or even Kafka, you can feel like they're anticipating a lot of these crises or anxieties that we're going through right now as we encounter those tools. I like the idea that artists might find redeeming uses for them. To me, the real issue, the real conundrum, and it's already true, but it's been true for a little while, is that it's not the sort of the high end. It's not like, you know, someone commands a machine to write a great novel and it's greater than any novel that a human being can write. I don't really feel that supplanting problem. It's the filling in of all the space where like ordinary language goes. The language that we use to just function. And you can feel this on the internet, that the bottom of the internet is sort of stacking up with like garbage language now that doesn't make any sense, that's not useful. And that it's like there's a theory in science fiction called the gray goo theory, which is about like nanotech and about the possibility that runaway commercial manufacturing machines, nanotechnologies, would would be given a command like, you know, make a lot of really cheap paper clips, and someone would forget to tell it to stop, and it would make the whole world into paper clips, you know, before they could figure out where the switch was. But I feel like that's actually gray goo is happening to language, that the underneath of our world of language is in crisis if you look at what the AI is doing. And also, there are language workers, not me, not novelists, but people who write ordinary things, copy and code and stuff, who are actually in danger from this misuse of these tools. But it's really great to keep talking about them as tools. Everything that a machine does is because some person told it to do it. So I just feel like make the conversation be about who's telling them what to do and why. And, you know, it's really not so different from every other kind of conversation we need so urgently to have. It's like seizing hold of the decision-making, the structural human decision-making. I mean, I don't mean to play that game of like every tool is neutral. I think there are much better and much worse ones. But fundamentally, they're doing what they do because people instruct them to. So when you hear the creators of these things sort of doing this, like, it's like a magician's trick of like, whoa, it's doing stuff. I don't know how it did it. And I don't know who told it to do that. And it's going to be smarter than us soon. I think that's almost always like this really disingenuous play. They are telling it what it should be like. They're making it. It's an object of human, it's a result. It doesn't have a directive of its own. So we should not let them pretend that they made it and then they can stand to one side and be like, oh, it's making awful things happen now. That should be an immediate signal to be like, well, then let me take over what it's doing. I think that a lot of storytelling comes to crisis around trying to advocate, right? It's just traditionally, if you know the answers ahead of time, if you're trying to produce a persuasive argument based on like your irritation with how other people think and you want to fix the way they think, it's pretty much a kind of famous recipe for dead on arrival writing of all kinds, poetry or songs or novels, science fiction or otherwise. I mean, sometimes someone who's trying to do that will inadvertently on the way make something more interesting happen, because stories are also alchemical. There's a mystery and a magic to our engagement with language. And usually when authors write stories, they don't know everything they're doing, even if they pronounce to themselves that they're going to write like the great, you know, exact Kropotkinite anarchist utopia to prove that it can be real. It would be a really, really grim reason to write a novel. But that person might also be helplessly, because it's what happens when you write, invoking feelings that they haven't examined and drawing on other cultural archetypes, and in that space, producing scenes of mystery and strangeness, even to themselves, that might be great. But still, it's a better idea probably not to be trying to like write to prove that even the world that you exactly want is possible. It's better to be a questioning, in a state of engagement and questioning. And, you know, and I mean, I sort of exaggerated that to the utmost with that story that's disintegrating before it can be told, right? But the spirit of inquiry and amazement, whether you're writing a dystopia or a utopia, or whether you're even sure. The last time I wrote a book really set in the future, I latched onto this term atopia, which is just the world you don't know. You know, it's not decisively predicated on an argument. And I think I feel pretty dedicated to that mode. It was interesting for me because you did sort of paraphrase something that a turn that happened that it took me by surprise because I was so committed. I grew up taking such sustenance from dystopian fiction. Some of the ones I mentioned, you know, I mean, some archetypal stories and authors like Orwell and Philip K. Dick. And this stuff really helped me when I was young. I mean, it helped me a lot because it seemed to be saying what the truth of the world was. And so I felt not crazy, you know. But it's also become true. And I think you hear people resisting the automatic dystopian story, the stock, you know, as it became a more familiar mode. And, you know, this even like kids are, there's dystopia written for children now, which is really different than when I was young. There's like reams of that. So it's become a little more automatic. And in that becomes the opening to a possibility of a cynicism or a just being a way to produce familiar, no defamiliarization, but just accommodation and distraction. Oh yeah, so this is a question about a novel I wrote. It was my sixth novel called The Fortress of Solitude, which was the first time I wrote about Brooklyn or any place really kind of mimetically, where I used a lot of the tools of realistic fiction, traditional prosaic description, lots of landscape and character development in that way. And yet it also introduced a radically disjunctive element. There were superheroes with real powers, and that wasn't explained or explained away. It wasn't dismissed as a dream or a fantasy. And so a lot of people did call it magic realism. And, you know, of course, if they meant that to say that they appreciated the book and they wanted to put it in the class of some of the other things that were called magic realism, I felt great about it. But the truth is, I always really felt a lot of resistance to that term because it's sort of like both terms in it seemed a little problematic for me in the sense that magic realism sounds like you know what realism is. And everybody agrees, and it's totally recognizable consensus definition. And then you went and sprinkled a little magic over the top of it. And I was like, I don't think that I agree with that feeling that that term is inspiring in me. Because to me, the reason I've always written things that are absurd or distorted or surreal or fantastical in some way, and I can't stop doing it, is that I think that realism is an inadequate description. It's like a genre of excluding the dream life and the ideological and the, you know, it's like exalted in some descriptions as like this, the highest or most serious kind of fiction that you can make or art you can make would be like a persuasive realism. But for me, the world I've known has always been injected with uncanny aspects, unexplainable or invisible elements. And I don't mean like ghosts, wizards, or fairies, like I just saw one over there. I mean like what we share together is uncanny fundamentally. The making of a consensual reality, the intricacy of experience is overwhelming, and our brains are devices of dreaming and confusion and proliferation and magic, and we don't agree on anything, and that even just to know what realism is a very, very confusing pursuit. It's not some settled proposition that you can then be like, and I added a little magic, you know? So for me, that wasn't a term I actually personally could relate myself to. I felt like, in that book, what I did was put an even bigger pressure on my own method, which is that I'm a surrealist. And so what I'd learned to do, it took me a while to learn to do it, was use, you know, like, if you look at a great surrealist painting, like by Magritte, there are elements in it that are unbelievably meticulous. And that makes what is impossible in it even more intense to experience. And I think in Fortress of Solitude, I was trying to get to that Magritte level of, you almost feel like you're looking at photorealism of the window, but then the guy is blue up above and it's nighttime under the street lamps. And I wanted that to be the effect, because it represented the feeling I have that the world is double. The world is this, you know, all these things we agree on really easily, the hard, you know, stuff, I'm holding this, it's there, it's on the table. And then the dream, the attempt to constantly wrangle other people's subjectivities and our own brains, is like a daily process of tripping, you know, and tripping with others who are tripping. I'm almost always fooling around with the multiple layers of what I work with. Syllables, sounds, you know, at the root, this like musical quality or absurd quality of like, blah, blah, what are these weird things? But also sentences or ideas or inversions of propositions. And then also I think about situations and scenes and set pieces, like that today I'm here and the wind's starting to pick up. It's like, this is a scene, you know? So I'm always, the material is, I mean, it's the only way one can be as an artist is to be amazed by the materials. If you're a painter, it's like the colors and the paint and the stuff. So it's always exciting, disturbing, and attractive to me. This is something I just came across. I was just reading an essay by David Graeber, and he was talking about the phrase art for art's sake. And I was amazed at the way he turned around. He was like, it's a art for art's sake, which is normally like seen as a kind of a Mandarin, aristocratic, depoliticized notion. You know, like artists trying to stand apart from the daily affairs that we must all engage with, could be seen almost as exactly the opposite, that artists who feel that they are practicing art for art's sake are actively modeling a non-commercial form of being, right? A zone of activity that is outside of capitalism, at least momentarily, stands that chance, right? And that's pretty exciting if that's true. It's like, it's one of those temporary autonomous zones. It's a little working area, you know, where you just make stuff. It's patently useless. It has no place in the market.
You've been listening to Essential Dissent. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode was the keynote address by author Jonathan Lethem, given at the first annual Upstate Anarchist Book Fair, held May 4th and 5th, 2024 in Binghamton, New York. Jonathan Lethem, spelled L-E-T-H-E-M, is the author of The Fortress of Solitude and Motherless Brooklyn, as well as more recent bestsellers, The Feral Detective and The Arrest. Several of his novels have been made into major movies, and his shorter works can often be found in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and many other venues. You can download this audio for free via radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4, all.net. Thanks for listening.